Welcome to the first Seagull Eagle podcast, the podcast that absolutely shouldn't work, but somehow it just does.
That's right, two neighbours, two very different football loyalties. I'm Andy, lifelong Crystal Palace fan, and he's Neil, Brighton through and through. Seagulls and Eagles, natural enemies on the pitch, but not over the garden fence. This podcast is, let's be honest, controversial in concept. But there we are. No beef, no brawls, and no terrace tussles here. Just strong opinions, dodgy memories of derby days, and some real talk about our clubs.
Each week, we'll bring you match previews, fan stories, trivia, transfer talk, and a few friendly digs at each other, all in good spirits. But it's not just Palace and Brighton. We'll be giving you our takes on the rest of the Premier League too. Match previews, results, and the drama.
With very little airtime for the so-called Big Six, this podcast is for the underdogs, the teams fighting for Europe and scrapping for survival. That's where the real football lives.
And when there's a hot topic lighting up the football world, we'll be on it. From VAR controversy to managerial meltdowns, you'll get our unfiltered take on the headlines each week.
So whether you're red and blue or blue and white, love your team or just love some good football chat, you're in the right place.
So grab a drink, stick on your scarf or burn your neighbours, and welcome to Seagull Eagle. Hello, Andy.
All right, Neil, have you had a good week?
Shut it. Actually, no, don't shut it. We've got to do a podcast. I've been dreading this moment, to be honest.
I mean, it's a good week to start, Neil. Let's be honest. I mean, we've had the game of our lives at the weekend, wearing my shirt proudly for the last few days. Got a bit of a hoarse voice for obvious reasons. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a good week, mate. It's a good week to be alive is what it is right now.
Is it? Mm. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah, my week's been pretty good. I had a lovely week up until about 3:02 p.m. on Saturday. Before that, it was fantastic, though. Let's just get straight into it, shall we? First of all, I think it's probably important to welcome everyone that's listening to our very first, our inaugural podcast, as it said in the titles.
Welcome, one and all.
Exactly. I hope you're going to get some entertainment out of this. I know Andy is already.
For this one.
Absolutely. So, Crystal Palace 2, Brighton Hove Albion 1 on Saturday, the 3 p.m. kickoff. It wasn't boring.
Far from it, Neil. Far from it. And I tell you something, what an atmosphere. Regardless of the scoreline to start off with, what an atmosphere and what a game. Right.
So let's talk about that then. So the atmosphere-wise, I mean, obviously you went to the game. You're a season ticket holder.
Yeah.
I didn't get a ticket for the away end, but I did go to the new Brighton fan zone, the terrace. So I'll talk about that in a minute, I suppose. But from your point of view, yeah, what did it feel like?
Oh, it was electric. Like edge of your seat stuff from kickoff. I think that, look, there's always something about Palace Brighton, right?
Yeah.
And we all know the history. It's not your typical rivalry. It's personal. It's passionate. You feel it in every chant, every tackle, every decision that goes for or against you. I think, look, the Homesdale was bouncing. The away team were loud, got a bit quieter at times. And you could literally, you cut the tension with a knife. I think it's one of those fixtures where you get to the end, that final whistle blows, which was quite a prolonged final whistle. And win, lose or draw, you're absolutely drained. You're exhausted. I think me and my boy, who comes with me to the game, I think we lost our heads at times, but we definitely lost our voices by the end of the game. It really was. I think, look, no one leaves without feeling something after that game.
Yeah.
And it really was win, lose or draw for either side. Jokes aside, it was a really, really good game. One worthy that should have been at the start of Match of the Day when you think about the emotion and the drama that went into it.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it wasn't. I really couldn't. Don't get me started on Match of the Day yet. It's far too early to lose listeners for that. Let's go through this chronologically then. So let's talk about the game and the atmosphere and things. And as I said, you were there What time do you get there normally on a Saturday?
Well, we drive up there, park and all that kind of stuff. So we try and get there a little bit early. But we went to the club shop and had a little mooch around. And then did the tradition, which is to buy a nice programme, have a little read, and then watch the teams come out. So, yeah, about an hour before kickoff, just to soak in the atmosphere, really.
Yeah. I get you.
And you went to the Brighton Stadium, did you, to watch it?
Well, yeah.
Is that a new thing?
Yeah, it's called The Terrace. And what it is just outside the actual stadium, they've built a purpose-built fan zone now.
Wow.
I mean, it's going to be used for other things as well, but it's a freestanding building that has four or five food vendors inside of it. It's a bit like a box park, I suppose, is probably a good way to describe it.
Yeah.
It has a mezzanine sort of level, so upstairs you've got more seating and that, but that's only for the posh seats normally. So that's on match day, that's for the Amex card holders, and you go up there and you've got more seats, more TVs, an own bar and that sort of thing. But on a day like Saturday, where they are going to be doing live beanbacks of the actual Live's 3 p.m. Saturday kickoffs, which I think is a fantastic idea. You know, we unfortunately in this country, we don't have the legal right to watch 3 p.m. kickoffs on a Saturday.
Is that a can of worms I just saw being
opened? Oops, sorry. I think it might change in the future. But for now, the opportunity to go to the stadium, get a live feed of the game on a Saturday whilst having a few beers, talking to friends, getting some food. It's fantastic. I have to be honest, it's the first one of the kind because it only just opened, I think, last week or so. It was a really good atmosphere, as I say, up until about, you know, 3:30 when we equalised. That was great, but we'll get onto that in a minute.
I'll be honest with you, Neil. I on my socials, I saw a video of the goal when you scored your equaliser, and it looks like an England international game at Box Park. It felt like a great atmosphere, mate.
Absolutely, so I agree.
Didn't last long, but
yeah. Okay, let's do this then, shall we? Let's do this. So, first of all, the lineups. I think the Palace lineup was pretty much what most people would expect. But was there any surprises from your point of view?
Yeah, a couple. Obviously, Richards was out, who's had a couple of really good games. Salerma started kind of out of position for us, kind of where he used to play at Bournemouth, really, on the right side of a back three. And I really liked him in that position. And controversially, Kamada starts ahead of Hughes on that game. He's had a bit of a nightmare recently. Probably talk about him a little bit later. But he did all right, you know. He did all right.
Yeah, I noticed that one. I think a lot of people were talking about that because that was the one that we were surprised about, I think, as a Brighton fan as well.
I think there was a mild groan, I think would be the best way to describe it, in the stadium when that was read out. however, he proved us wrong. Fair play, Kamada.
I think from an Albion point of view, we were probably as we expected to be. I think the only real surprise, so if you look go back a week or so ago, we've picked up a couple of injuries in the week. The game against Villa, Jorginho Rutter, who's been fantastic since we purchased him in the beginning of the year, he got an ankle injury, so he was out. We knew he was out, but the question was who was going to play, you know, who was going to fill that position. And there's been so many different changes this season. I don't think we've played the same lineup maybe more than three times. So when it came to it, O'Reilly was put in place in that sort of number 10 position. And for him, I mean, that's fantastic. It was a bit of a surprise, though, I think, for Brighton fans, because we sort of got used to the idea that maybe Fabian Hertzler didn't quite fancy him. He came from Celtic at the beginning of the season. Yes, he's had his injury issues, but the last month or so he's been fit, but not playing. So to then start him in a Crystal Palace game. Yeah, exactly. Ooh. Exactly. So we were a little bit surprised. But generally, as I say, the rest of the 11, they were as expected. The only one that I think before the game I was worried about is our right back situation. And I think as the game started and as it went on, I think Crystal Palace knew that was a problem too. So Jack Hinshelwood, who's by trade a midfielder, yes, he's played right back a few times, absolutely, but he's not a right back. You probably have to say he's our fourth choice right back, really, in that sense, behind Ferdi Kadioglu, who we bought in the summer, who's been injured all the way through, Joel Veltman, who everyone loves to hate, and of course, we've got Tarek Lamptey as well. All of them are injured. So we were stuck with Jack Hinchwood, and that's not fair to him. I don't mean it in a horrible way.
It's a bit
harsh,
Neil, to be
fair. He's playing out of position.
You're describing scraping of the barrel here, aren't you? Do you know what
no,
I mean?
No, I would call him my first-choice midfielder, just not my first-choice right-back.
Interesting, then. Both teams playing a midfielder as right-back.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
So that was it, really, for I think, from a starting lineup perspective. And then I suppose we have to get to it.
Can I, before we just do do you mind if I just got a little stat in my pocket? Is that all right? So this win at the weekend was the first time in 92 years, Neil. 92 years that Crystal Palace have achieved a league double over Brighton. So that was 1932 was the last time that happened. And do you know what happened in 1932? Just to put some context around this, George V was king, right? They were in the middle of the Great Depression. And most importantly, Weetabix, the cereal, other cereals are available, was invented in that year. That's how long ago this all happened, that we got the league double over Brighton. So that just shows you...
What a great team Brighton have been over the years.
How bad Palace have been for that long. However, we've righted our wrongs. And that's why every Palace fan now is joyous. And they should be, because it's a big occasion, really, getting that league double over you guys.
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, you know, as sickening as it has been, for me, I won't go into it now, but the first fixture was the one that really sort of put the nail in the coffin for me. That hurt more in some respects, you know, because I think, you know, you go away to Selhurst Park, you know it's going to be difficult. So that from that point of view, it's fine, you know, just the way it was.
The game.
Yeah, the game. Let's talk about that, shall we?
Yeah, let's. Well, here's an interesting situation, Neil. As I said, I went there with my boy and I thought, do you know what? It all happened so quickly at the start. So quick. They came out of the blocks early. And it was 3 minutes, that first goal from Mateta. In fact, I still had a full pre-match cup of coffee in my hand as that goal was scored, much to the disbelief of the two people sat in front of me who ended up wearing that cup of coffee after 3 minutes. It was really quite hot and quite an embarrassing moment. We were all friends at the end, though. So I think, look, we came off the blocks early. I think it was a great pass from Gay from midfield. He does that charging from defence through the mid-lines there and played a great little pass. And I think the goal from Mateta, whether you're a Palace fan or not, you can't argue with it. It was a cracker.
Absolutely.
And it all kicked off. Right, the corner flag went flying and every Palace fan was, absolutely joyous. Then, from my opinion here, I think it changed a bit, actually. I sat in the stands. I started feeling a little bit nervous. I thought that you guys were piling on the pressure. And if it wasn't for... who should be England's number one, Henderson, I don't believe that the scoreline would have been the same. I think he did a big double save there. And I think it could have been a very, very different first half, I think, if that had gone in.
Yes, I tend to agree. I think, however, I'd make one slight change of observation, which is I don't think it was all Brighton. I think Palace made a decision very much early on that they were going to do, as we like to now call it, a Nottingham Forest and and sit there. They've got the goal. They could sit there and they could counter-attack, which against Brighton is the perfect plan. You know, I won't get on my soapbox just yet, but the counter-attacking teams against Brighton of Albion always do well. And so that, I think they also made the decision to say, well, actually, do you know what? You can have the ball. Let's see what you do with it. And to be fair, you know, we did put the pressure on, but I don't think we had many gilt edge chances. I think there were a few that the keeper, you're quite right, did get to. But I wasn't sitting there in the first sort of 25 minutes thinking, oh my God, how are we not four up? You know, it wasn't that sort of feeling.
No. I think from my perspective, sitting in the stands, which is a lot different to watching on telly, as we all know. But I kind of, there was moments of nervousness as you kind of broke our lines quite a few times. And there was some quite kind of nervous moments for me where I was like, this could change quite quickly. And I felt like our team felt a little bit kind of comfortable at times and it could have turned quite quickly. But look, it was a strong first half from us. And then when we move on to, Danny Welbeck's goal, I mean, it was well-positioned goal, about 6 yards out, wasn't it? Good assess from Minter. I think you broke us down and you put the pressure on and it happened.
Yeah, I agree. I think Minter is a bit of an enigma at the moment. He has fantastic games. He goes missing in other games, but that cross, you know, he cuts back, hits it on the left, cuts across in to an angle that is so difficult for anyone, even the defenders. If they touch it, it could go in, you know. So the fact that Danny Welbeck managed to get on the end of it and put it in, you know, obviously I was happy. So were all my friends and everybody else in the fan park, as I'm sure a lot of people watching TV were. But I think it was at that point, I think it was anyone's game. I think it felt like, oh, Brighton are on the ascendancy. We're going to get another one now. We're going to, you know, really put pressure on. But there was always that little bit of a inkling, you know, and that worrying in the back of my mind, because every time Palace did get the ball, our fullbacks were so high up, in particular Jack Inchelwood, who was cutting in to join midfield, which I'm sure he was told to do, by the way. This is not on him. But from a tactical point of view, you know, that hole in Palace's left wing, our right back position, you know, it was there for the taking a lot of the time. You know, as soon as they got the ball, they would go, or you would go up the wing, you know, and make a break for it. And there were a few of those occasions, a few of those situations where, you know, the warning signs were there, you know.
I think I think you're right, Neil. I think that's one of my kind of takeaways from the game, which was the from a Palace perspective, you got Mitchell and Munez on the wings. I think they worked really, really well for us, and kind of unmarked actually and open to roam, which seemed to be something you hadn't picked up on as a team on that pitch. One thing actually, just to note, I mean, we've got to give you praise, right, as we go, and I feel like, you know, poor Danny Welbeck, right? He's lost the game. However, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Neil, that he's actually now your all-time top goal scorer in the Premier League.
That's correct. I mean,
31 goals.
Absolutely,
now.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, Danny Welbeck as a whole, you know, we all know he's had a long career, very hit by injury through his different teams he's been to. But he got to Brighton, everyone was a bit like, well, we're not really sure what the point of that is. And then, lo and behold, for whatever reason, hopefully we can praise the medical staff at Brighton, but for whatever reason, his body seemed to rejuvenate. It seemed to stop having injuries. He's had a few, but nothing like his previous career. And suddenly, yeah, he's been here a long time now. And yeah, you're right. Top Premier League scorer for Brighton of Albion. And, he's such a role model now as well. And I think that's something that Brighton does very well. You know, they bring in two or three very senior players that have had a good career. And Welbeck currently is that leader, is that person on the pitch as well that really helps the younger players. And props to him. Fantastic to be the top scorer for Brighton in the Premier League. And I think also this is probably, I think he's on 9 or 10 goals now for the season. And if he gets to 10, unbelievably, that'll be the first time he's ever scored 10 Premier League goals in a season.
You're kidding.
Crazy stat.
Okay. Well, there you go. There you go. And then, do you know what? Something I'd like to talk about, Neil, is the craziness of the second half, right? So before that all happened, we've got a superb bit of footwork from Eze, who basically set up Munez for that lovely finish that he did to make it 2-1. Everyone goes mad.
Yeah, he's a lovely footballer. I can't lie. It is wonderful to watch when he's not playing against Brighton. He's really enjoyable to watch. It was a really beautiful move in that sense. Got a little bit lucky with the shot, didn't he, Munez? I think it came off Purvis Estupiñan's back foot. So that slightly wrong-footed the keeper, but ultimately, you know, they were there to put it away, weren't they?
It's almost a pre-rehearsed routine that you saw there with Munez, really. It's kind of, he plays that move quite often, and quite often he gets a deflection. I think before he signed for us, he was popping in 5 or 10 goals a season. So I think he's been unlucky since he's joined us not to get more, really. But I think he's a genuine inspiration, that guy. And I think he's my son's favourite footballer, actually, out of the whole team.
Okay.
And no one works harder than him in terms of distance covered, sprints, all that kind of stuff.
I was going to say that. He's up and down that way.
Yeah.
Unbelievably.
And I love it that he's the one player on the pitch that's always got his hand in the air. He's always like, pass me the ball and get him into space and all that. So he's a very clever player. He really, really is.
Yeah, no, props to him. You guys get the second, 2-1 up. And to be fair, at that point, I'm annoyed But we're all of us are like, well, we're still in it. It's a close game. We're always going to have the possession. That's just the way it is, really, with those sorts of games. So let's just see if we can do something with it. The problem had been up until that point, and that was the sort of the worry, that we hadn't really, as I said in the first half, even up to that point, we hadn't really caught, you know, created so many gilt egg chances or anything like that. We'd had a couple of half chances, but nothing major. So that was the feeling. It was a little bit of like, oh, uh-oh, you know, we're still not really firing on all cylinders here. So what are we going to do? And as you say, I mean, that was early in the second half, that second goal, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And then we made some changes. O'Reilly went off. We actually ended up playing more attacking than normal in some respects. But I think that's Fabian Hertzler. When he's in that sort of situation, he wants to try and attack rather than do anything sort of more than different than that. The game just carried on. Nothing huge happened. Like there was little chances, little bits of this, but generally speaking, it was a fight in the midfield. There was essentially just, you know, playing the ball around, trying to find gaps in Palace's defence, or sort of 8, 9, 10 man defence in some respects, because they sat back nicely and well done, in a great shape.
Well, you knew where it was going to go, didn't you? Because I don't know about you, but the tackle started flying in.
Yeah.
The shoulders and the elbows, the two-footed tackles. And in the stands, we were like, this is going to get interesting. Thank God Will Hughes wasn't playing, because he wouldn't still be on the pitch. Yeah. And I think is now a good time, Neil, to talk about the dismissals?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we need to talk about one particular substitution first, which is Eddie Nketiah.
Mate. Would you funny you should say this, because I've got quite a bit to say about
this.
Go on. I genuinely believe that poor old Eddie the Eagle, he's had an absolute nightmare, right? He's worst day in the office that you could ever have. And to be honest, the more I look at it, and I did take a bit of a look at this last night, and I was like, could he have done anything differently? And I genuinely believe he's just had a nightmare. Like,
yeah.
And I don't think he meant any of the stuff that's going to happen, and I'll explain why. So he's had a really bad time of it recently. Obviously, he's joined from Arsenal, but he now seems to be getting some chances in the cup. He scored 4 goals out of 6 substitute appearances, and he's come on to replace Mateta in the 68th minute of the game. What, Neil? What a chance to shine.
Yeah, right? Absolutely right.
Absolute
Especially in this game.
Yeah. He could be the hero again, like he was the game before last. Maybe not. He's had an absolute nightmare, as I said. And from what I could see, he pretty much only had 3 touches of the ball. The first touch was to receive a superb through ball from midfield. I think it was from Wharton, but don't judge me on that one. He gets the ball and he thinks he's on at goal. Immediately he's offside. And I could tell that a mile off. He was miles offside. The second touch, he was clearly through on goal, 1 defender to beat, and he gets booked for simulation. Now,
do we want to talk about that? I'd like to talk about that.
Because truthfully, I think, let's talk about that in a minute, because I'm going to come to it, actually. And then the third touch, 10 minutes after coming on, in fact, I think it was only 9 minutes, actually, he raised his leg to control the ball as it goes past him, right? So he's facing the ball as it comes to him, and he turns round, and Van Hecker is trying to header it, and he gets a second yellow card, and it's over.
Yep.
And he walks off, right? Yep. So now we look at that and you go, poor lad, he's got 10 minutes, he's had a nightmare, he's walking off the pitch and he's thinking, where did it all go wrong, right? I'm going to tell him where it all went wrong. The first yellow, obviously, he was facing the other way. The ball went past him. He turns around. Van Hecker's there. But Van Hecker, his head, if you have a look at it, and I watched it again on Match of the Day, if you look at it, his head is actually waist height.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So he's got, granted, he's got his leg up, but he's actually not even, he doesn't even know that the defender's behind him.
I'm not sure waist high, unless you wear your trousers really high, but I definitely agree that Van Hecker's head wasn't at head height. It was definitely stooping down to head the ball. Absolutely.
And I don't disagree with the decision, by the way.
No.
What I think my point here is, he's just well unlucky. It's one of them days where he goes, just weren't for me.
Okay. So I agree with the second yellow. That's an unlucky, but it is a yellow.
Yeah.
So then the question is the first yellow, which was, as you say, simulation. So if that's his choice. So his choice is to, as you saw him do. Yes, he did get a touch, absolutely. But his next foot, his right foot, where he didn't get the touch, he goes to put it down and decides not to put it down. He decides to forget to put the foot down so that he falls onto the floor. And then I think that's the issue that the referee's got. That he's gone past the defender and he has the ability to put his foot down, but he chooses not to. He chooses to, when you see the replay, it's, you know, it's not instant. The point is he goes, oh, hang on, I've got touched. I'm going to go down. Most, that's not fair. A lot of more successful strikers find that a lot subtler and they find a way of, oh, I've been touched, I'm going down. This was a problem with this, I think, was the fact that the speed of thought wasn't as quick as the speed of foot.
Get it? I get it, Neil. And do you know what? I think he's being judged on his previous endeavours. And let's be honest, he has got a little bit of a rep from his Arsenal days for collapsing like a sack of spuds. Mm. And I think that actually, though, again, I looked at it and I've listened to a lot of opinions online. And I think there is a lot of impartial opinions that would say that he did get touched. He was running at such pace because he was through on goal that I don't think there would have been a chance for him to stay on his feet. However, he did do a Tom Daley-esque dive at the end, which I think in hindsight he will regret, because I think if he didn't go down quite so prettily...
And I think that's the point. I think that's the point.
But I do think actually, if it had gone to VAR under different circumstances, there might have been a penalty and that would have changed the game.
Yeah, I think the problem is you've got now, I think there's two things to think about. And this is more general. It's not necessarily we're talking about Nketiah, but when we talk about simulation and things like that, this season, the referees, one of their sort of adjustments, let's say, to the way that VAR is being done now is that they're very much on the side of whatever the referee's decision was on the pitch, unless the VAR can see an absolute travesty of justice or a complete cock-up, they're going to side with the referee. So I think in situations like this, where Nketiah's stumble isn't very particularly subtle, I think that's the problem with it. And that's where the issue lies. And look, on a different day, you're quite right. I think a different referee may have made a different decision.
Oh, and look, Neil, from the stands where I was, I mean, I was like, he's dived, right? Yeah. And everyone around me was like, he's dived. It wasn't until I watched it that night on television and saw the close-up, I was like, actually, there was contact and there was something there. However, we don't need to worry about that because the result went our way. I'll tell you something else that made me tickle, though.
Go on.
I like the moments in the game that aren't necessarily the moments everyone else talks about. This one was about Mark Gaye.
All right.
What a man, a legend. However, he got two yellow cards as well and ended up on the hit list walking back down the tunnel. However, he didn't make a quick exit to that tunnel. I don't know if you noticed
this. No, I didn't see that. What happened?
It was a great moment. One of which, when you're in the game and you're wondering what's going on. So Mark Gaye gets sent off for his second yellow card. I think it was a high-footed challenge, I think. And it was in the 90th minute, right? That's when we're now two men down. And it's not looking pretty for us. We're thinking, you know, you're on the attack. So Mark's like, well, do you know what? I'm going to take my time. And superb antics. He basically walks diagonally pretty much from your penalty box all the way to the opposite corner flag.
Wow.
Diagonally, very, very slowly, staying on the pitch for as long as physically possible. So much so that your keeper decides to come over to him as he gets into your half to try and help him along. And the referee even actually tells your keeper to back off. Look, first-class gamesmanship, or a word that I would have used but can't. And a fine example of, I think, what we would say is the dark arts at play from Gaye there. And I think the Palace fans really enjoyed that. Exactly what you want to see at a derby.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it was position was the other way around, we'd be doing exactly the same thing.
And he knew exactly what he was doing, and that's what I loved about it. Unfortunately, he now misses a game, but anyway.
Well, yeah, and so does Van Hecker as well, because obviously after that, we had, 12 added on minutes to try and get some sort of result out of that. Two extra men. But the issue doesn't change. You know, the issue doesn't change. Brighton trying to break down a low block, and that's a tale as old as time, if you ask a Brighton fan.
He nearly did, though.
Nearly isn't good enough. You know, literally with two extra men, Andy, we should be, you know, we should be doing something. You know, ultimately, we should have come out with a draw minimum of that game.
Fair play.
We had 12 minutes, you know, 12 minutes to do something different. And the problem I had with it from a tactical point of view, I'm not a manager, obviously, and I don't have all the qualifications. But my difficulty with it was we put so many attackers on that we ended up not quite knowing where everybody should be. And we just passed and passed and passed and passed. That hadn't worked for the first 90 minutes. So why was it going to work for the next 12? What I would have liked to have seen was a little bit more of actually just taking your man on and moving people around. And they didn't do that much.
And when you did do that, you did break us.
Correct. Yeah. We had a couple of chances where we just took on a player, beat someone, which meant someone else had to come across, which created a hole, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we did it maybe twice in that 12 minutes. Right at the end, didn't we? We got that chance where it managed to actually get into the box. It dropped down for a Yari. Great save by Henderson. But then, you know, thankfully we all knew it was a Yari, so he was never going to score. I don't think he's ever going to score for Brighton Hove Albion. He's had so many chances this season, bless him. But yeah, of all the players for it to fall to, Yassin Ayari was probably behind Verbruggen. It is what it is. Congratulations, Crystal Palace. I think, you know, ultimately they had the better of the chances. You know, we had the possession, but they had the better of the chances. They earned those 3 points.
And what a game. I mean, look, like, again, scoreline aside, a really, really interesting game. Palace were the first team in Premier League history to win a home game having received 2 red cards.
Really?
So, like, that, there's some... I tell you what, looking into this game, there's some, just some brilliant, brilliant stats in it because just so much happened. So much happened. And it's like, you know, it's just a great time to be alive, to be a Palace fan. I mean, it was 6 years ago that Brighton last won at Selhurst Park. We've got a club record 12 Premier League games in a row for scoring. So that's 12 games we've scored in a row now, which is the club record, which is ridiculous. And also, get this, right?
Go on.
This really, really made me happy. In 2025, the calendar year, you know you're clutching at straws when you're doing calendar year
now
stats.
Now I know this because I looked at this myself earlier today. Yeah,
Palace are the third best team in the Premier League behind Arsenal and Liverpool. And can you imagine if we'd have actually won one of our... first 8 games or whatever it was that we couldn't manage to do. So I think, look, it's a great time to be alive. I think Henderson, for me, man of the match. And Kamada actually contributed in a football game and kept up with the pace. He's one of the top earners at the club. He's taken some serious stick from me personally on them stands. And I've done, you know, deep intakes of breath every time he's come on the pitch and all that kind of stuff. However, Saturday was a good day for him. A much deeper midfield role suits him. I'm happy to be alive, Neil.
Okay, let's stop talking about that horrible game. I did want to just touch on a couple of things then. So the whistle blew. Yeah. And at the end of the weekend, what that means is... Mm. Albion, they stay on 47 points, but that means they drop to 9th now after all the other results. That's still only 1 point from 7th, though, so there's still quite a lot to play for from that point of view. Yes, it's a bad week overall as well, because if you think about it, we lost in the FA Cup last weekend.
That is a bad week.
It's too bad we didn't start the episode last week, but we don't have to talk about that. FA Cup loss, Villa loss, and now Palace loss. So 3 losses in just over a week, exactly a week. So that's tough. That's a tough week from our point of view. And as you alluded to, I think it's since the turn of the year, I think it's 15 games you've played. You've won 10, drawn 3. I think that's an amazing form that you're showing at the moment. I think we'll stop there. We'll take a break. And then if it's all right with you, Andy, we can get off this subject and talk about the rest of the Premier League.
Sure, you don't want to carry on talking about
the
game?
I'm all right, thanks.
Okay, see you in a bit.
And welcome back to Seagull Eagle Podcast. So, Andy.
Neil.
Thankfully, we've got off the subject of Palace Brighton, but there were some other games this weekend. One of the ones I wanted to talk about, the Ipswich Wolves game. I don't know if you saw the highlights or you saw any of it. It was Ipswich 1, Wolves 2. Ipswich started by scoring the early goal, and I think everyone got very excited, especially as they'd won the last game. But The only thing I really want to talk about was there was a moment right through the, I think it was in the first half. It felt a little bit like the 1990s when the passback law first came into football.
Okay.
We had this scenario where goalkeepers didn't know what the hell to do when the ball started coming back to them. They suddenly realised they couldn't pick the ball up or anything and things like that. And it was a little bit feeling a bit like that, because what happened was the ball got passed back to, what's their keeper's name, Alex Palmer. And he miscontrolled it. He basically put his foot over the ball. He wasn't really looking at the ball. He was already looking to pass somewhere else. Didn't control it. It went under his foot and it starts rolling towards the goal. And you can just see him sort of, you know, like gasp and start sprinting after the ball. And he's not going to get there in time unless he dives. So he dives, he passes the ball out, but uses his hand to do it. And that means that it's a handball, but it's an indirect free kick because the goalkeeper does it. But he literally handles it on the goal line. So then you've got this wonderful, as I say, sort of old school football moment where the referee can't put the ball on the goal line, but he has to put it somewhere. So he puts it on the 6-yard line box. You've got 11 Ipswich players lined up in goal, all trying to stop this next free kick that's going to happen. How the hell the free kick is supposed to go? Yeah, it was just wonderful. You had like literally visually 21 brilliant players and a referee inside the 6-yard box practically. And it was just funny to watch. I love those sorts of things, you know, where you get to see it. They didn't score from it. I think it's probably harder to score in that situation in some respects. It's not, it's not really an advantage. But Wolves did go on to bag the winner. And it meant really that Wolves were in a position of strength really from that point, because the gap between the bottom three, you know, it's huge now. It's not going to happen. You know, nothing's going to change. So, so that felt like a real sort of seminal moment, that result. I think I'll move on from that one. The other thing that happened on Saturday was the West Ham-Bournemouth game as well. That was a fun game, I think, from the looks of it. I watched some of the highlights. I think the main thing to probably take out of it is two things. One, so Graham Potter, ex-Brighton manager, took over from West Ham a few months ago. I wouldn't say it's been a huge change. I wouldn't say they've had like some sort of amazing bounce back in their results or anything, but he's definitely steadied the ship.
He hasn't made them worse, has he?
Well, that's a fair point. He hasn't made them worse. I think my biggest surprise with West Ham is actually with a Brighton hat on is Evan Ferguson. So our teenage striker, he's actually 20-odd now, but he started coming back into the league in the league when he was 18. He scored some great goals in the last couple of seasons and everyone thought, oh, he's the next big thing. He's had illness, he's had injury, and so he needed a loan. He needed to get out to play some regular football. And in January, it was agreed for him to go to West Ham. They just had a striker injured, obviously. Mm-hmm. Antonio got in that horrible car crash. Thankfully, he's getting better now. So we were all thinking, okay, great, he's going to get some minutes. I mean, he's had hardly anything. He's had one start. He's had five other appearances as a substitute. No goals, obviously, nothing like that. He didn't even get on Saturday. And I just don't, it's a real scratchy head moment. I don't really understand why the decision was to put him there if Graham Potter's not going to play him. The whole point of sending someone out on loan, you know, you would think there must be some stipulation in the contract to say he's got to have a certain number of minutes or something like that, because it's just a waste, you know, it's an absolute waste. Especially now Brighton have got injuries, he might have even got a look in. So
I guess the emphasis has got to be on the kid, though, to perform, right? He's got to get himself picked, so
I get that.
Know what's going on the training field.
I get that. And I think that's something that our loan department, Albion's loan department, need to think about, because if they knew that maybe wasn't quite what was happening, because it certainly wasn't happening at Brighton, he wasn't getting a look in, maybe you need to put him in a team where he's definitely going to be one of the better players. So drop him down to the Championship, get him in a Sunderland, in a Coventry, somewhere where he's going to play because he's one of the better players. Give him the minutes, get him hardened, get him scoring, get him confident, you know. And that's the frustration, I think, from a Brighton fan, and talking to others, I think they agree. But still, you know, he's sitting there. Hopefully he'll get some minutes at some point before the end of the season.
I mean, if he can't play at a big team like West Ham, then if he comes back down to a smaller team like Brighton, he might get a bit better.
Do you know
chance,
what? I
right?
knew you were going to go there.
I mean, it's just, you know.
I'm not even going to bother. Bournemouth, I think that's another thing to talk about. They've had a fantastic season. But you'd have to say that they're probably having a little bit of a moment. You know, they're faltering slightly. They've dropped points in the last few games now. I think they ended up now being 10th at the end of this weekend, 6 points behind Villa. They've they've not really had a great run. Statistics wise, you know, they've really dropped a lot of points in the last six games.
Well, look, they had a cracking start, though. They had a cracking start, and some would say they kind of overperformed at the beginning of the season. Yeah. So maybe it's all just levelling out a little bit now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing, isn't it? You know, it will level out. We'll know that, you know, some of the bigger teams will end up in the European spots, like Brighton, and some of the other smaller teams will finish 12th, where they always finish.
Hey, listen, we're comfortable with 12th. and mathematically safe, actually, by the way, which we need to celebrate as well.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? You so do celebrate that.
It's the first thing to celebrate in a season.
The 5:30 kickoff in the evening, Aston Villa versus Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, so both teams with Champions League ambitions went head-to-head. Villa's dream start of back-to-back goals from Rodgers and Marlon turned into a second-half struggle, to be honest. But they stood firm to secure another vital 3 points. I thought Tielemans and Rodgers were superb in the first half. I really, really did. And in the second half, everything changed when Jota Silva pulled one back for Forest. It was a big moment. Villa held on, though. All in all, I mean, there was plenty going on in the game. Villa are now 1 point behind Man City in fifth. Forest end their four-game unbeaten run. So Forest won't be happy with that. They would have wanted to get them 3 points. But look, it's a good game.
It was a good game, I agree. And as you say, the second half was end-to-end. I was surprised, actually. I thought before the kickoff, I thought... Forest would at least get a point. I thought they might get more. And the reason I thought that was because Aston Villa this week have got a really big game in the Champions League as well. So they've got to go to PSG. So I, again, like Arsenal, I was thinking, oh, maybe they'll have a little eye on that rather than the home game against Forest. But no, that they held on, didn't they, basically,
they
at
did.
The end there. And Forest, again, I think they're in a position now where it will take a lot for them to drop out of the top, what will be the top five, because I think fifth place now is almost guaranteed to be Champions League. So, it was an end-to-end game, and especially in the second half, and it was a good watch for a lot of people.
I just can't believe that we're even talking about that, about how well Nottingham Forest are doing. It's just insane.
Let's touch on that a bit later, actually, because I've got a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
Move on to Sunday, shall we? So we had a few games on Sunday. We had Brentford, Chelsea, Fulham, Liverpool, Spurs, Southampton, and the Manchester Derby. Let's start with possibly the worst game of the weekend. Brentford, Chelsea.
Oh, shouldn't take long, Neil, to be fair. Is there much to talk about?
0-0. No, that's it. Let's move on. So Fulham, Liverpool, that was a bit more of a rip-roaring affair.
Oh, look, what a game. Wow. Liverpool's 26-match unbeaten run in the Premier League has come to an end as they were beaten at Craven Cottage. They took the early lead with McAllister's amazing 25-yard strike. Did you
good.
See it?
Yeah, I mean, it was good.
What a goal.
Ex-Brighton.
Yeah. Couldn't keep hold of him though, could you? But I mean, he's gone on to better things, and he deserved it. And then moving on, sticking with the game, 3 goals in 13 minutes. Mm. 3 goals in 30 minutes for Fulham changed everything. So you got Sessegnon, Iwobi with a deflection from Andy Robertson, and then you got Muniz, a cool and calm finish there. Liverpool pulled one back in the 72nd minute with Diaz in the bottom corner, and then Elliott came close to equalising, but it wasn't to be, Neil. It just was not to be. Liverpool now 11 points clear, 4 wins in their last 7 games. They couldn't muck it up, could they?
I don't think so. I mean, let's get it right. If they do, it would be spectacular.
They have been known to do this kind of thing.
But then, you know, you've also got to think about who's chasing them. Man City aren't chasing them. It's only Arsenal. And the way Arsenal are playing at the moment, I think they've stopped as well. And I think that's the other thing to think about. You know, you say, sorry, how many more points do they need?
They need 4 more wins in their last 7 games.
4 more wins. So they need 12 points. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So they need 12 points, but that's only if Arsenal win every single game.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's going to happen either. So, yeah, I get the feeling that by the time Liverpool come to the Amex, which is the second to last game, I'm pretty sure they'll be on the beach and hopefully we can get a nice 3 points off them.
I'm pretty sure we've got them at the end of the season as well.
Well, there you go.
And we have been known to ruin their parties. but also, just as a finishing note, Fulham are now up to 8th and I think looking good for Europe, right?
I think they're definitely in the mix, aren't they? I think they're you know, as we were talking about Bournemouth, they're on the other side of it. I think, you know, Bournemouth are starting to drop. Fulham are keep going. You know, they're doing really well. They've got some really exciting players. It's nice, and as a side point, I think it's nice to see Ryan Sessegnon getting some minutes. He's had a huge problems over the last three or four seasons with injuries. You know, he was at Spurs and really hardly ever got a look in because he was injured all the time. He's come back to his club because that's where he came through as a kid.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to see him on the pitch. Let's move on to the very last game. Well, actually, I say the penultimate game because actually there's a game tonight as we're recording. Leicester v Newcastle. We'll have a little nosy at the score in a minute, but I doubt we'll talk about that one. I think more importantly, let's talk about the Spurs-Southampton game. And although it's not a particularly important game, I think the result ended up being quite an important result. So it was Tottenham 3, Southampton 1. What that does mean is that Spurs managed their first win in 5 games, which, I mean, you'd have to say, you know, it's been a horrendous season for Spurs as well, a bit like Manchester United, very similar sort of in the way that they've been completely consistent with their inconsistency, I think is a good way to put it. What it also means is that they won against probably the poorest team, some would say, in the Premier League history. I think, you know, the result did mean, because of Wolves' win on the Saturday, that it put the nail firmly in the coffin of Southampton. They were officially relegated on that final whistle, which is also, I think, the earliest within a season that a team has been relegated as well, which does highlight how bad Southampton have been. And then probably it's worth also talking about the fact that as of today, we heard the news, the headlines, that Southampton confirmed in a statement that they'd agreed to, by mutual consent, I love mutual consent, that their manager, Ivan Juric, will leave the club immediately. Having lasted, though, I want to point out, 108 days.
Isn't it weird that you get a team relegated and then you go, or then you get sacked, whichever way round it was? Why did that not happen before it was too late? What good is it now?
Well, I think this just highlights the issue with a lot of owners these days. Gosh. You know, I mean, God bless Tony Bloom, but you know, you look at this season for Southampton. So they got promotion from the Championship, and it was a surprise. They got through the playoffs. You know, they weren't the ones that we were expecting. A lot of people were expecting to come up, but they did it. That's what the playoffs are about. Sometimes you get a surprise and they manage to get up. And that's fantastic. Russell Martin, he's a progressive manager. He's cocky, but he's you know, he has his own style. And he refuses to change. And I think that's where they went wrong. You know, right at the beginning of the season, Russell Martin wanted to play the style of football that they played in the Championship at a level where he didn't have the players available. And I think that's where the problem lies.
Well, there's that thing, isn't there, which is like, do you reckon the managers are sticking to their guns now and saying, no, I'm going to stick to the way that I play and my philosophy because they think it's better for their careers as opposed to the club? I mean, look at, you know, what happened last year. Like, you get a team relegated and you get the Bayern Munich job because of your philosophies and the way you play. So what's more important, the manager's career or the club?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely bang on. I think you look at that and you think to yourself, special Russell Martin, I think he's in the early part of his career. He's trying to set his standard. So I don't necessarily have a problem with him doing that. However, at the same time, if he wants to win football matches with Southampton, there has to be a tweak. And he didn't do that. Yeah. So they made a change. Ivan Juric came in. And by all word on the street, he lost the players within the first 2 or 3 weeks, was what I was told. And, you know, essentially that they weren't playing. And you can see that from the results. They had a little, you know, a few maybe odd point here or there. But generally speaking, you know, the season didn't change. You know, nothing really made a difference. So,
I mean, I think that's an understatement.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
The stats show that he's got the lowest win rate in Premier League history. 0.29 points per game. Right. And I think let's just look at this a little bit further detail.
Yeah, sure.
He won an FA Cup game at Swansea.
Yeah.
And a league win for Ipswich. He got a point at Palace where we made them look like Barcelona. And that's pretty much it. I mean, that's hardly success, to be brutally honest.
No, absolutely. I mean, you put Russell Martin and Ivan Juric together, that ended up with a Premier League record of currently 31 played, 2 wins, 4 draws. And for those who don't not good at maths, that's 25 lost games. Goal difference of minus 51, and that's 10 points, which I think is important then to talk about the fact that those 10 points are currently the lowest ever points tally in the Premier League season. So they, if they don't get any more points, they will actually be not just the first relegated in history, but the lowest tally of points. Derby County 2007-2008 got a grand total of 11 points.
Interesting, isn't it?
I mean, it's something to aim for at least.
I mean, they've got Leicester coming up, so well, I guess, exactly. You know, there might be a saving grace. They're also the lowest scorers in the top 4 divisions of English football, right? That's where, I mean, there's some really, really embarrassing stats, but yeah. I think a lot of this comes back down to the fact that truthfully, I think they had a better team last year in the Championship to the one that they've got this year.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of it all triggered from the transfer business at the start of this summer season. They weren't quick enough to get deals done, were they? No. They missed out on loads of key players. And I mean, there's too many to even talk about that all ended up at different clubs. And I think that, you know, they, as I say, they had a better squad last year than they did this year. So I guess not all the manager's fault. I think the new owners, Sport Republic, I believe, are the ones that own them. I mean, they got relegated, promoted, and now relegated in 3 years. To sum it up, really, definition of a yo-yo club. At least it's not Palace anymore.
We are now going to go to a new section called Swooping Statements. This is where we dive into the bold, the unpopular, and the controversial opinions about our clubs. That's Palace and Brighton, by the way. In this feature, we'll challenge the status quo and take a hard look at the takes that might ruffle a few feathers. Whether it's a hot take about tactics, player performances, or even club management, we're not afraid to stir the pot and have a tough conversation. So here we go. Buckle up. Today, it's going to be your turn, Andy. So I believe you have a swooping statement for us. Hit me.
It's not a popular one. It's not a popular one, Neil. Eberechi Eze.
Yep.
I love him.
Mm.
It's not a declaration of love, though. But he is tough to watch.
He's tough to watch.
He's tough to watch.
Okay, elaborate.
Well, I think, look, he's had a slow start to the season. Mm-hmm. And he struggled to find his form from previous years. Right, to put it into perspective, mm-hmm. last couple of years, bearing in mind he was playing alongside Elise and the likes, and he was coming in double figures in terms of goals, providing really high stats in assists and opportunities and all that kind of stuff. Now, this year, he's only managed 2 goals so far this year. But when we start looking at his shots on target and his accuracy, it kind of tells a different story. His shooting accuracy is 25% so far this year. He's had 87 shots. 87
wow.
shots. Now, only 22 out of them 87 were on target. And how many did he score? 2. 87 shots, 2 goals. I think what that should be saying is maybe pass the ball a bit more and stop shooting from the halfway line. I think, look, he's well up there for his chances created. And I think that's the thing that we all love about Eze, taking on the man, getting himself in the position. And it's like when he played for England the other week mm-hmm. and he came on as a substitute and he was the only one brave enough to take the opposition on and run at them and not be afraid to lose the ball. However, this is my issue with him. He loses the ball too much. Watching Palace from the terraces, you could fight for 5 minutes to get that ball back.
Mm.
You get that ball back, you're building play up, that ball goes into Eze and it's so frustrating to watch him immediately lose it.
Mm.
Or do a really strange sideways pass or whatever it would be. I think sometimes his sloppiness has kind of got the better of him this season. He's got the makings of such a good player, like a top player. But I think there's a reason that none of the big teams have come in for him and paid that big money that's needed to prize him away. Now, Neil, don't get me wrong. As I said to you when I started this all off, I love the guy. Not only is he a brilliant footballer, he's a great ambassador for the club. He's an England international. He's also a lovely guy. Like, he takes the time to sign autographs, meet the kids, all that kind of stuff. I don't want him to move on. I love him at the club. is just sometimes a hard watch. However, that all being said, he did have a really good game on Saturday. He did. And he was up there ranking with the best of them. So hopefully now he's hitting form and he's realising what life without potentially Elise is. And fingers crossed, he passes the ball a little bit more. I think sometimes when you've got a player who's struggling for goals, they'll shoot even more and be even more erratic.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Do you see the rest of the team getting frustrated at him shooting?
Absolutely.
Do you?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. There's positions where everyone's getting themselves into the box and he's taken a shot where it's never going to go in. Mm. It's the same with free kicks and all that as well. I think he's making some ludicrous decisions, which I think actually a more sensible kind of approach, a pass into the box or a through ball onto people who are in the correct position, yeah, ready to just tap it in. I think he's kind of been a victim of his own demise a little bit when it comes to these stats. I think he's looking at them going, I need to right the wrong, I need to get them goals. Yeah. Whereas actually, do you know what? Maybe that's not what he is. Maybe he did do 10 plus goals for the last two seasons. I'll tell you what, I think any Palace fan would take assists over goals because we've got a goal scorer, right?
Yeah.
And I think. So as a frustrating watch, I don't believe I'm alone in this, but I do believe it's controversial. But hopefully he is coming good again now.
Shoot less, pass more.
Yeah.
That was a swooping statement. So in other news, I think it was probably worthwhile just touching on a few things. I know a lot of the football teams this time of year publish all their finances, and that's been a lot all over my Twitter feed or X feed at the moment. I think one did make me laugh was the Leeds United budgets and the Manchester United ones. I'm just a...
Boring.
Yeah, sorry about that. So what I will do, though, is move on and talk about something we just touched on earlier when we talked about the results on the weekend, and that's Nottingham Forest. Nuno Espirito Santo, who was voted March's Barclays Manager of the Month. That was winning his award for the seventh time in his history. Yeah, that shocked me for a moment. Then I suddenly remembered that he was at Wolves, obviously, for quite a long time, where they did well. They got into Europe at one point, and... obviously he had his very short spell at Tottenham Hotspur that probably a lot of people forget. However, he won Manager of the Month twice in the 3 months I think that he was there.
Mad.
Crazy. But yeah, I just wanted to touch on that. Congratulations to him, and more broadly, congratulations on Nottingham Forest, really. Just what a season.
Yeah, I mean, imagine, right? You got Liverpool, who are, you know, riding clear at the front of the Premier League. And, you know, he's not won the Manager of the Month again. I mean, what else can he really do? And you've got Nuno there who's just rewriting the rules and setting history. I mean, it is genuinely phenomenal. How do you feel that he and Nottingham Forest have done so far this season?
Oh, I mean, I think everyone's been surprised. I mean, I honestly thought they might be in a relegation battle at the beginning of the season. So, I mean, I'm looking pretty stupid at the moment, but it's been amazing. They've bought some really good players. I think if I'm being honest and fair, I think he's also though had a lot of luck with injuries or the lack of. I think they've been pretty, they had such a great start, no injuries. A lot of the other squads have really suffered. So I think they've done really well. His style of football is very, as we know, you know, counter-attacking. I think if you look at the stats as well, though, I think they've scored first in a huge amount of all of their games, which has given them the perfect platform to then counterattack and cause problems for other teams. So I'm not calling them lucky. Don't give me any hate, anyone. But I'm just saying that I think they've had a season where everything has aligned pretty well for them. I would be very surprised if next season is the same, because they'll be in the Champions League. They'll have to invest in their squad. And I also think other teams like everything that goes around here, you know, people work you out and you come, the people come up with other plans. So they'll have to come up with other ways of doing things. That's not to say that they may do that. But yeah, it's been a fantastic season. And I'm sure Nottingham Forest, if I was in their shoes, that, you know, what an amazing journey they've had this season. It's just been fantastic. Just back to Nuno Espirito Santo. So as I said at the beginning of that piece, he's he's won that award now 7 times. There are 7 managers that have won the award more times. So Nuno's on a level with Mikel Arteta and Rafael Benitez at the moment.
Okay.
But above them, there are 7 other managers. And I wondered if you could think of all 7. Go on, give it a go.
Well, I mean, look, Pep's got to be in there, right?
Pep. Oh, let me grab my phone. Let me have a look. Pep Guardiola. Correct. Yes, he has won it 11 times.
Not surprised. Then I guess you're going back a bit in my mind. I think we're back to the golden days of, you know, Man United ruling everything and the Alex Ferguson era. I'm sure that that's a thing.
Of course, absolutely. Yeah. And he is miles ahead. So he has won the award 27 times.
Wow.
Yeah, so if you think about that, Pep Guardiola's been at Man City for 10 years, pretty much.
Yeah.
He's only won it 11 times, which is very strange in itself. Mm. But yeah, Sir Alex Ferguson, 27 times.
That's mad. He must have won it every month.
Sir Alex, anyone else?
Well, sticking to the same era, you got Wenger.
I did not see it.
yes, that's right. 15 times he's been awarded the Manager of the Month. So that's 3. You've got 4 more to find.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Klopp.
Yes.
Liverpool.
Jurgen Klopp, absolutely. Yep. 10 times. Somebody else has also got it 10 times. So it's Jurgen Klopp and.
This is where it starts getting tricky for me.
Go on.
I mean, Mourinho? Is he up
no,
there?
No. Is he not? He's not? No. Yeah, I know. I was surprised by that too.
Ooh. Okay. Right, I'm going to go a curveball.
Yeah, go on.
Someone who I love and I loved as a manager and I still love listening to now, Harry Redknapp.
Well done. Harry Redknapp is on that list. He has won the award 8 times.
What a legend.
Yeah, I agree.
What an absolute legend.
Right, so you've got 2 more to find.
I'll be honest with you, Neil, I think I'm stumped.
All right, well, let me give you a clue then. So one is a Nottingham Forest legend as a player. He used to manage the team that's currently in a relegation zone this season. Irishman. You're not going to get it, are you?
No.
Martin O'Neill.
Oh, Martin O'Neill.
Yeah, he's on a par with Harry Redknapp with 8 awards. And then you've got 1 more to get. And I will give you another clue with this one. He's currently a manager in the Premier League.
Oh.
Mm, still about.
But he's won it of old. Like, ooh. Nah, don't know, Neil.
No, he's David Moyes.
David Moyes.
I mean, he's been around forever. Yeah.
Do you know what? This is the thing. It's the longevity, isn't it?
With that,
he's had many a year to win it.
Yeah, he's won it 10 times as well. So that was,
wow.
I just thought it was an interesting list when you look through that. I think the surprise of Martin O'Neill being on that list and only seeing Pep Guardiola 11 times out of the 9-10 seasons that he's been here. I just thought that was quite an interesting
Martin O'Neill, I wouldn't have guessed in a million years, mate. So let's move on to now the more important and pressing matters at hand. What's going on for Brighton and Crystal Palace next week in our feature called Winging It, where we fly straight into the week's biggest matches for Brighton and Crystal Palace. In this segment, we're going to break down the upcoming games for both clubs, offering predictions, key players to watch, and what could make the difference in these vital clashes. Well, Brighton have got Leicester.
Yeah.
Lucky you.
I know. I'm thankful, to be honest, after the week we've had. I'm not going to take it for granted, but certainly it's one of the better fixtures to have. I think, you know, Brighton at Leicester, if we think about the return, the first fixture, I went to that game up at the King Power Stadium. We were 2-0 up. We were coasting. And then we switched off, and they got two goals back. It was one of the first games, I think, that Van Nistelrooy was in charge of. They had a little bit of new manager energy, if you know what I mean. That soon dissipated.
I was going to say, did that ever happen?
Yeah, for about 10 minutes against Brighton, basically. So we drew that game, which was really, really frustrating, and it was a very long drive back because of that. But this one, yeah, I do expect Brighton to bounce back, if I'm honest. I think it's one of those games that if we're serious about getting into that sort of top seven, top eight positions, we have to win this game. There's no excuses. Let's put it this way. If we don't win it, I think that's pretty much our season over from that point of view. So I would expect it to happen. A few things to think about. Obviously, Van Heek got the red card on the weekend against you. So that will mean that he's suspended. What it also means, though, with our centre-backs, we are a little bit thin on the ground now. As I mentioned already, we've got no right-backs. We've also now only got a semi-fit, match-fit Lewis Dunk, who played his first 90 minutes in 2 months, I think, recently on Saturday. It means that without Webster, without Van Hecker, and without Igor, we now move on to Aaron Cashin, who is our new January signing, who we got from Derby. He came on for the Villa game for, I think, the last 15 minutes, and he was okay. He was trying to do the right things. I think it's great that we've got a left-sided centre-back because it gives different shape to when you're trying to attack and things like that. But obviously, he looked nervous at the pace of the game, I think he'll even admit was a little bit quick for him in that sense. So I can't imagine they'll play anyone else in there unless Hörsler does something different, which is puts Baleba or Weaver in as a centre back. But I think if you've got Cash in there, you've got to trust him and try it. As we said, it's against Leicester, so that may give Leicester a chance, especially with the shithousery of Jamie Vardy. I think that's a perfect opportunity for him to take someone to the cleaners. So I am slightly worried in that. I think I can't see it being a clean sheet for Brighton, therefore, because of something like that. So I'm hoping that Brighton will come out winners 2-3-1, something like that.
I think I can only see a Brighton win, but also we get into that time of the season, yeah, aren't we, where the guys down the bottom are going to start fighting for their lives, and you just never know, do you?
Absolutely.
Just never know. But I can only really see a Brighton win, and of course the Eagles visit Man City, which is a really, really interesting game coming up, because you'd think going into this that's a clear and easy win for Man City in terms of on a normal situation.
Oh, yeah. Historic-wise, you would, wouldn't
absolutely
you?
However, when we go back to, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but you go back to the fact that Palace are the third most informed team in the league right now, you start thinking to yourself, do you know what? Could it be a repeat of that 2-2 draw that we got there last time? I don't know. Look, with two teams are on form, it's a really tough place to go. We all know that. And I can see a tricky game. I think in my mind, I've got a feeling we could get something out of it. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. However, thanks to the wonderful Brighton, we are two players less than we were before we started this, which was obviously Gaye is going to be suspended. Who's the biggest of the two losses out of it. Judging by the fact that it's not just what he gives us defensively, he's a forward-looking defender, right? Mm-hmm. He's looking for them forward balls. And I think he's also a leader, right? So yeah. I think he's going to be missed. However, we're hoping that Richards will come back from injury. There is rumours that he should be ready to play at the weekend. So let's see whether that happens. And of course, we've got our 9.5 to 10 minute wonder, Nketiah, who won't be available to come off the bench, which does mean that maybe we'll get a look in from some of the other players that are on that bench, which might be quite nice. I'm going for a 2-2 draw.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation, and I think it'll be a very similar game, I think, to the Brighton game, ironically, in that, you know, Man City will have the possession, And you'll do what you've been doing, this counter-attacking. You've got such great speed. You've got great skill up front. Therefore, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I think there's an opportunity there to score goals. It's just whether you can keep them out on the other side. So, yeah, I tend to agree with you, but it is Man City. They are playing okay.
Yeah.
I think Man City will just get past you. So.
And I think that's the hindsight of not being the optimist that I am about my
absolutely.
Own club.
Because
I think the deep down, I kind of do feel like that might be the case, Neil.
Yeah.
One thing I do hope, though, is with Nketiah injured, suspended, I do believe that might open up potentially an opportunity to get a couple of the other guys on, as I said. And I think like França, who's one of my favourite new signings, who we signed 2 years ago, the Brazilian wonder kid, you know, I'm sure we'll discuss this later. Rumours has it he's got a Ballon d'Or clause in his contract and loads of exciting stuff in there for him for the future.
He's got a Ballon d'Or contract.
Oh,
what?
I feel like that's for a whole nother podcast.
Okay,
Neil.
Okay. Stick a pin in that one.
Yeah. However, he did come on and score the other night. And I think it might be a nice opportunity for him to come on once Mateta's legs start going. So let's see if we can do something special. And look, let's be honest, Neil. If we can get that win or even get a point, maybe European football's not too far away for us. Let's see.
I doubt it. Let's finish it there. I think that's a really good way to end our podcast this week. I think we've covered everything we need to cover. I think I've had enough of talking about Palace, to be honest, for this week. It's been hard for me, but I showed up. Horrific timing of the first episode, but it's just the way it has to be, I suppose.
Oh, dear.
Listen, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Cheers for listening, everyone. That's it from us on our first ever Seagull Eagle podcast. Two neighbours, two clubs, and one slightly ridiculous idea that I think might have somehow worked. Look after yourselves. Avoid any Brighton highlight reels. And, of course, up the Palace.
Up the Albion.